Funding for the World War I Living History Project is provided by the National World War I Museum at the Liberty Memorial in Kansas City, Missouri. Experience, learn, and honor those who served in defense of liberty in our country at the nation's only federally designated museum honoring the veterans of the First World War. Online at libertymemorialmuseum.org.
This is Will Everett with the conclusion of the World War I Living History Project. A dozen years ago, while living in France, I paid my first visit to the trenches. I had heard that after the armistice, with 500 miles of trenches to deal with, some had been left intact for posterity, exactly as they had been when the soldiers all trudged home after the war. One such sector was at Ypres, a medieval town of fairy tale splendor in western Belgium that had been leveled to the ground in World War I. Farmers in the area still plow up old gun stocks, bullets, and bones in these flat, placid fields. One misty morning, I met a World War I veteran, a man in his mid-90s being led by the arm by his elderly son. They might have been just out for a cold-weather stroll, except that the old man seemed to be looking for something. They were walking along an observation platform, looking down into the trench, which was so much deeper than it looks in pictures. Every few yards, the 90-something-year-old man would peer into the trench, then up at the nearby ridge, as if trying to get his bearings. Later, while the father was walking alone, I spoke to the son. I asked him if his father was a veteran, and he said he was. I asked what they were looking for, and he said, "After it rains, things come up from the mud. Things that have been buried for 75 years suddenly come to the surface, and with the next rain, they sink back again forever. You can see the strangest things." Belgium's World War I veterans are all gone now. The last one died in 2004. Scotland lost its last veteran a year ago. The last Austrian and Hungarian veterans both died in March, an odd coincidence, considering that the two countries were once part of the same empire. As of October 2006, France and Germany each had 8 veterans. Britain had 5. Canada had 3. At the start of the year, the United States had 24 surviving World War I veterans. Now there are only 14. In some ways, it was the memory of an old man staring down into that tomb-like trench that sent me at the beginning of the year to document the experiences of America's surviving World War I veterans. I encountered a lot of people along the way who would say, "Oh, my dad or my grandpa was in the war," until they realized that I was talking about the other World War. Invariably, they'd do a double take. Wasn't that around 1915? Then they'd do the math. It was a very long time ago, and I realized as I began traveling across the country to interview these centenarians that this country would soon be coming up on the end of a historically important era, an end that not too many people seemed to know was even approaching. They weren't members of the greatest generation. Newsreel photography was scarcely out of its infancy when they were slogging it out in the trenches of Belgium and France. Sound movies hadn't yet been invented. Without much to remember them by, history seemed all too willing to simply let them go, these veterans and their distant, hard-to-reach point in history. Historians mark the end of any major era with the passing of its last veteran. The last Revolutionary War veteran died in 1869, 86 years after the war. The last Civil War veteran most likely died in 1953, 87 years after the war. It's been 88 years since the armistice. The veterans remaining represent only 0.03% of the original 4.5 million doughboys. Given that one of the veterans, Emiliano Mercado del Toro of Puerto Rico, is 115 years old, perhaps it's conceivable that one of the youngsters of the bunch, the 105-year-olds who snuck in as boys of 16, will be around for the centennial of World War I. Frank Buckles, for one, says he plans to live to be 125, and I believe he just might do it. The veterans interviewed for this program are not the only U.S. World War I veterans out there. There were surprisingly few veterans who couldn't be interviewed, but there were some for whom time had simply taken too great a toll, but who should be remembered, like Charlotte Winters, a Navy veteran and the oldest female veteran in the United States, or Emiliano Mercado del Toro of Puerto Rico and Albert Wagner in Kansas. And then there are the veterans who signed on too late to be considered World War I veterans, like Robley Rex, Stillman Munger, and Maurice Starkey. And we cannot leave out a curiosity like Harold Gardner, who got on the train to go to boot camp on November 11, 1918, and was told to get off the train a few hours later when the armistice was signed, and received a paycheck of $1 for his one day in the U.S. Army. The surviving U.S. veterans of World War I aren't a brotherhood of heroes. You realize right away that the story isn't about heroics on the battlefield. The war touched all of them, but not in the way you come to expect when you approach veterans to hear their stories. Their wartime contributions were simple, their military service sometimes unpleasant, but usually dull. But most of these old soldiers had a few things in common. For one thing, they were all quite young. They were between 16 and 21 when they joined, and anxious to see some action, about which the curious interviewer can hardly help wanting to know more. We tend to think of veterans as tin soldiers who live on as symbols of this war or that. Part of my search for the last World War I veterans was a search for common ground, a connection to the past that would help me to understand such a remote point in time. When it came to talking about their personal lives, I found that not much had really changed. As John Babcock was patient to remind me, they were healthy young men who did what healthy young men are prone to do.
I heard a lot of stories about France, about the guys fraternizing with the prostitutes. I remember one fellow telling about visiting a prostitute, and they gave her some francs, and she put them in her stocking, and she had a hole in the leg of her stocking, and the francs were falling out as she walked down the stairs. He followed it on, was picking the francs up. Oh, you heard a lot of stories in the service, believe me.
Tony Piero.
Beautiful girls. They're all over the place. There was one girl in Bordeaux. She was a saint. She was nice. A girl said, "You can have any part of me. I'm too busy. Busy being a soldier."
Howard Ramsey.
When I was over in France, on leave one time, I remember we took a walk and we met a couple French girls, and we didn't have any money, so we took us home where they lived, and we met their mother and their father. So we had quite a nice time as long as we knew those two girls. They were just, you know, about the same age as we were.
Homer Anderson.
Oh, yes, I danced lots of times. I liked lady friends, and that was one way of having a nice lady friend, because they loved to dance, the majority of them. And I was a pretty good dancer in that age. Met quite a few nice young ladies that way. Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, these were innocent romances that didn't go very far. But not always. Samuel Goldberg.
In that cheetah, there was just one prostitute. She kept busy. And then the baker, the bread baker, he marries her. He married this prostitute. I put the paper through.
But 112-year-old George Johnson was too busy having adventures. The story of his life is an adventure classic. He told me that before I could understand his military experience, I had to know something of how he first came to learn that the world was at war. When George was about 16, he and a friend were canoeing on the Delaware River near Philadelphia when they came upon an Argentinian battleship. Naturally, they wanted to climb aboard and look it over, and while Johnson was down below, the ship pushed away from the pier, and he was carried off as an accidental stowaway.
I looked around, I couldn't see the wharf. What in the wharf? Where's the wharf? I noticed a fellow standing at the opposite side of the deck. And I said to the guy, where's the boat? Where's it going? I never will forget the words he spoke. La vapor, si vamos a la Buenos Aires. The boat was going to Buenos Aires. That's where it was going. Sailing down the Delaware River. Going on its way to open sea.
He spent 2 years trying to get home. And it was while traveling to England on a merchant ship that he first learned of the German submarines that were now prowling the Atlantic. He arrived back home just in time to be drafted. Understanding the world of 1917 and 1918 meant understanding how these men filled their incidental hours, what they did for fun. As it turned out, life was pretty mundane for the average soldier or sailor in World War I, but they always found ways of livening things up. John Babcock.
We had a canvas shoes we used to wear for athletic work, and they used to put our overcoats on, our greatcoats, and our canvas shoes, and we used to go down to the ocean in Bexhill and go swimming. And we'd throw our overcoats off and our shoes buck naked. But it was about 6 o'clock in the morning and people weren't up yet, but anyway, nobody bothered us. It was chilly.
Samuel Goldberg.
After the meal at night, a lot of us would play poker. I'll tell you a funny one. The 24th Infantry Negroes came over, and they were playing blackjack. And so I got into the game. I had, $10 or so. And I won, within an hour or so, I won a very tidy sum, $125 exactly. $125. And I decided to quit. I said, it's not going to run my way too much longer. And I walked away 10 steps or so, and the guy by the name of Dawson approaches me, one of our cavalrymen. He said, "Hi, Goldie, we got a game going, stud poker." Well, right there I should have stopped, because I'm good at poker, very good, not at stud poker. I think no more than 15 minutes to lose $125. And to this day, I'm mad with myself. 87 years ago, almost 90 years ago. And I still have bad vibes over that. Funny, isn't it? Follows you the rest of your life.
Ernest Pusey.
On board ship, they play a lot of cards, and they get into those crap games and wouldn't stop until somebody was broke.
Military service also taught the veterans lessons about themselves, some of which they had to learn the hard way.
When war was over, we were allowed to go ashore and buy beer. I wasn't much of a beer drinker, but that day I drank too much. And they walked me up and down the street to get me sober to go aboard ship. And I just walked right up to the dock and walked right down in the water. And they pulled me in. That's the way I went aboard ship.
I'd just been paid, and I had about 3 cocktails, whiskey and soda or whatever it was. And then I went to a restaurant and had a meal. And I felt kind of drunk. And I went home to camp, and I got in bed, and the guys had left a fire back up by my bed, and that was the last time I got drunk. I wasn't a good drinker.
The First World War was also a cultural phenomenon, a time preserved in song. When I visited John Babcock in Washington State, I was curious about the music of the time. I wondered if he remembered the old songs, and would he share them with me?
Pack up your troubles in your old get bag. Smile, 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 while you've Lucifer to light your fag. Smile, boys, that's a style.
Keep bag and smile, smile, smile.
How are you going to keep down on the farm after they've seen Paris?
How are you
going to
keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? Hey!
And then that song that came out, Katie, beautiful Katie, you're the girl that I adore. When the moon shines over the cow shed, I'll be waiting at the kitchen door.
Girl that I adore. When the moon shines over the cow shed, I'll be waiting at the kitchen door.
When I first approached the Office of Veterans Affairs for a list of World War I veterans, I suspected there might be others. 80% of the VA's World War I records went up in flames when the records center in St. Louis burned down in the 1970s. The only veterans known to the VA were those who received medical checks. Then, during the production of this program, the VA got a call from a man in Rhode Island checking to see if any of his old cavalry buddies were still around. As it turned out, not only were Samuel Goldberg's buddies gone, he was the last cavalry soldier left. Goldie, as he sometimes calls himself, was a rarity, the last witness to a little-known corner of World War I history with contemporary significance. He was posted on the U.S.-Mexico border following the Pancho Villa raids as part of an effort to thwart a possible German invasion through Mexico.
We drilled every day. I used to laugh and say, we're fighting the Indians again. Get out there in the morning, right on, right after breakfast, and run around that desert like you were fighting for your life. I laughed. I laughed at it in 1918. I was an 18-year-old kid, and I laughed. I said, what are we doing? Fighting, drilling to fight Indians? We were supposed to be guarding against Germans coming through from Mexico. The Germans had their group in Mexico with the intention of crossing into the U.S., and logical enough.
His travels along the U.S.-Mexico border also brought him in contact with Fort Brown in Brownsville, just down the road from our studios.
We spent like 5 months there in Brownsville. We were, this is a false alarm, they were going to ship both squadrons of the 12th from Columbus and the Cheetah down to join the other squadron in Panama. And we were supposed to get summer clothes and so on and ship off from Brownsville for Panama. But they canceled it.
The World War I veterans I met for this program all had their own attitudes about longevity. People would say to me, I bet they all drank and smoked right up until they were 100. And actually, many did smoke in their early lives, and many still drank in moderation. But for the most part, the veterans I met had been living moderate, sensible lives for some time, watching what they ate and what they drank. I asked them to share their secrets. How can one reach the age of 105, 110, 112, and be as robust as these guys seem to be? Frank Buckles.
What's important is you got a strong desire to live. Recently, there have been a number of stories about longevity. One thing that all of them had in common was work, outdoor exercise, and a desire to live. So you're going to ask me, how long am I going to live? Well, I make it to 125, I guess.
Tony Piero.
Just like anything that's alive, you take good care of it, it lasts longer. That's the whole secret. You don't create trouble for somebody else. You don't get trouble back.
Russell Buchanan.
Just remember it, and what you eat, especially what you drink. I stick to a little bit of beer, and I don't recall any liquor. Stop smoking. 1949. I haven't smoked ever since then. Heck, that's over 60 years ago.
George Johnson.
As long as I feel like I do now, my voice is getting a little crusty, but as long as I feel just like I do now, I feel just like I did with 110. As long as you don't have any pain, no constant ache, I think the average person would feel just as normal, you know what I mean? A lot of them will say, I lived a lonesome life. But I say this, my secret is this, don't find little things to upset you. See what I mean? Don't find little things to upset you. You're never going to be satisfied with everything. So if you're going to let the little things accept you, affect you, they're gradually going to build into larger things.
I came to think of the World War I veterans as Generation One, born in the 19th century, the first eyewitnesses of the 20th, holding on into the 21st. They remember the world before the airplane, before the Soviet Union, before radio, a quieter time. And these are quiet men. They're curious about the contemporary world, But many, or perhaps most of them, have become scholars of their own long-ago time, a time most of us have forgotten. They care about how people remember the First World War. They want to be remembered. Frank Buckles.
President of France, Jacques Chirac, decided to give the surviving members of the French army, give them the Legion d'Honneur, and he decided to include the Americans. I became a member. A few people knew that I had been in World War I, but not more than five or six people, including my daughter and wife. I never told them about it.
Lloyd Brown.
I used to belong to an organization of World War I people, but I think they got so the number of members became exhausted.
They had a magazine.
Yeah, all the subscribers died.
The starting point of knowledge is the story. Begin with a story and you can travel through time. The veterans of World War I had taken me in a time machine with their stories, and they were expert navigators. But they were very old men, and the ultimate story was still to be told, and they wouldn't be around to tell it. I wanted to know their feelings about what happens next when you cross to the other side. The results were mixed. Samuel Goldberg.
Well, you're dead. What do you mean? Well, what do you mean, heaven and hell and... Oh, no. I'm not in any way religious.
John Babcock.
I think that if you live a good life here, you have a chance afterward. I think if you lead a bad life, you have a chance to go to hell. I think there's a hell and a heaven. I'd hate to think this all just happened by itself, and I don't think it could.
Frank Buckles.
I know what I'm supposed to think, but I just don't see how it's going to be possible. When you pass 100, you start counting the years, then you know that there's a final end of it. Up until then, you don't give it much thought.
After you die, I think that's the end of your life under any circumstances. You're gone. You're gone forever. When that consciousness leaves the brain, that is the end of it. That is the end of your life, your existence, on this earth.
The latter was George Johnson, 112 years old when I interviewed him in May. He lived alone in the house that he and his late wife had built in the California Bay Area in 1930. He was blind but in great health, a loud-talking soothsayer with a sharp wit and great stories. George introduced me to another reality of this search for World War I veterans, one that I hadn't thought much about, until George died 2 months later. He was the oldest man in California, and I suppose I should have seen it coming. I had gathered these men around me like old pals, and suddenly one was missing. And then a month later, 109-year-old Homer Anderson passed away. He had trained for the Balloon Corps in World War I, an aborted effort by the Army to send men over the enemy lines in helium balloons, which the Army discontinued when it was determined that the balloonists presented too tempting a target for the enemy.
I was in the balloon section for quite a while. It was a training team, and that's all we got done. We didn't get any engagements, and I was awful happy about that.
As an interview subject, he was what I'd come to think of as a drifter, nailing a question solidly but then drifting to other topics, other wars, places where I had trouble following. He once surprised me by calling out to his late wife, gone more than 20 years. Perhaps she was already beckoning him from the other side. A month later, he was gone. When you meet a veteran of World War I, you're in their life for a couple of hours, as long as it takes, but they stick with you for weeks and months as you hear their words over and over. Their way of speaking, their values, their sense of life, it all starts to work its way in. You don't want them to go, but you know they will. And then one day the circle is completed. The era is over, and the veterans of World War I will join the ranks of those who gave their service in other wars, in other times. For every army raised by an Alexander or a Nero or Napoleon or Pershing or Patton, there must be the last man standing, the last eyewitness, the last link. And then, that era is relinquished to history. But this is a tribute to the living. While one eyewitness is alive, World War I is living history. World War I is truly the forgotten war. Its causes are vague, its goals unclear, its heroes largely forgotten. I approached the subject of World War I with the memory of a Belgian veteran peering into a trench one rainy day a dozen years ago, looking for whatever would turn up in the mud. Time will move beyond World War I, as it will move beyond World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and Iraq. Time moved beyond that 90-something veteran I met in Belgium, but the legacies of his war are with us today. World War I was the beginning of the New World Order. The United States, which lost comparatively few lives in the war, gained the most in terms of international stature. American values were shaped by the events of 1917 and 1918. World War I also gave us the Treaty of Versailles, and with it the economic strangulation of Germany that gave rise to Adolf Hitler and the death of millions. World War I gave Russia the impetus to raise a 12 million man army, and with the famine and hardship that resulted, brought the 300-year-old House of Romanov to an end, giving birth to the Soviet Union. It killed the European monarchies and gave birth to parliamentary rule across the continent. A complete understanding of the 20th century begins with a study of the First World War. The bungling course set by a handful of diplomats, politicians, and generals in 1914 is the course we sail by today. Those men are gone, but another handful remain as witnesses to a fading time, an obsolete idealism, and a universal love of liberty. It is to these surviving veterans of World War I that this program is dedicated. My name is Will Everett. You've been listening to the World War I Living History Project. Major funding provided by the University of Texas Brownsville, Texas Southmost College, www.utb.edu, and the South Padre Island, Texas Convention and Visitors Bureau, online at sopadre.com. Additional support comes from the Liberty Memorial in Kansas City, Missouri, the National World War I Monument and Museum, online at libertymemorialmuseum.org, Creative Care Consultants, in honor of Charles E. Waldron, Jr., and by the Marine Military Academy in Harlingen, Texas, online at www.mma-tx.org. Voices in Hour 1 include Ray Stewart, Chris and Eve de Diesbach, Gerald Scherer, John Rogans, and Andy Hancock. Original music by Chuck Wild, used by permission of Gold Mask Music, ASCAP. Videography and production assistance by Joel Lamar. The World War I Living History Project was written and produced by Will Everett. Special thanks to Veterans Affairs Liaison Chris Scheer and guest host Walter Cronkite, as well as Carl DiCapo, General Stephen Burkheiser, Charles Waldron Jr., Robert Machen, and Charles Waldron III. To order a CD set of this program, visit www.thelivinghistoryproject.org, where you'll find video and audio samples, contact information, and links to more information about the First World War. This has been a creation of Treehouse Productions.